Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Hardcore Finance Podcast with Alex and Shimon. Today, I'm very excited to introduce a very, very special guest. Super excited to have him. It's Wasim Ahmad. He's the Chief Crypto Officer of a company called Vault 12. And actually, Wasim is a serial entrepreneur with five exits. And he's an advisor in the fields of AI, blockchain, cryptocurrency, and various encryption solutions. Currently at Vault 12, he led the private and public funding of one of the world's first STOs and focuses today on expanding Vault 12's ecosystem. His crypto experience began with AlphaPoint, where he worked with the founding team to launch the world's first cryptocurrency and cryptocurrency trading exchanges. Previously, he was a founding member of Voltage Security, a spin out from Stanford University that launched identity-based encryption, a breakthrough really in public key cryptography, and pioneered the use of sophisticated data encryption to protect sensitive data across the world's payment systems. Wasim serves as the chief of nonprofit Startout in New York and is a Seedcamp and WeWork Labs global mentor. He graduated with a Bachelor's of Science in Physics and French from the University of Sussex. And we're so, so excited to have Wasim. So Wasim, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Alex. Great to be here.
Glad to have you. Can you tell us a little bit about, you've had a long and storied career, especially all up and down the world of security. Can you tell us a little bit about Vault 12, what you guys focus on now and kind of your path and what led you to Vault 12?
Sure. So Vault 12 is a system and a mobile app and a platform that lets you protect, backup, secure your cryptocurrency assets. If it works with any blockchain, it works with any type of digital asset, and it basically enables you to make sure that the most important credentials, could be your seed phrase, could be your private key, are backed up into a digital vault, so something that's very similar to a digital safety deposit box, and is protected. And because those credentials basically represent the actual assets themselves in the world of cryptocurrency, it's very, very important to have those backed up. And so the way the backup works is, instead of storing this in the cloud somewhere or storing it in some kind of local device or in a mountain in Switzerland, the contents of your vault are actually distributed in pieces, encrypted pieces, to some people that you name out of your personal network. So trusted friends and family, maybe your lawyers, maybe other professionals that you work with. And they basically safeguard those pieces until you need them, at which point they're reconstituted and you have access to your assets. So it's a very different way to protect your assets, but it's done in a very, very decentralized way, very distributed, so that the assets remain secure from all of the things that can befall people's seed phrases and private keys.
Yeah, so thank you for that. That's great, and it sounds extremely innovative. Well, let's talk a little bit about the innovation there and what you guys are doing. But maybe one upfront question is, it sounds great, but why can't I just leave it on an exchange? You know, I have a password manager, I have two-factor authentication, I trust Coinbase in the space of crypto, let's say, to hopefully not get hacked. And I have all my standard backups. So why not just leave my coins on an exchange?
Well, that is a reasonable question, but hope is not a strategy for protecting your assets. So unfortunately, in the last couple of years, it's something like 3 billion, it might even be like 4 billion now, dollars worth of crypto assets have been stolen directly off exchanges. So hopefully they'll keep it safe is just not good enough anymore. That's one aspect. Another aspect is that there is a difference between how cryptocurrency, the markets associated with cryptocurrency work versus what we're used to on a day-to-day basis with the stock stock market, stock exchange, bank accounts, accessing those online. With a bank account, you know, if you forget your password, you just press a button and your password's, you know, sent back to you. Maybe you get a phone call, maybe you get a text, but it's a very, very straightforward process that everyone's familiar with. With cryptocurrency, you lose your account details. They can't be recovered. And so that's one of the reasons why you really have to think about doing the protection. And that's really why we're in business is to help you do that, because it is complicated. All of the benefits of the cryptocurrency space that you've talked about on your podcast, before, they come about because cryptocurrency, the blockchain, these enable you to be your own banker, essentially. So you become responsible for those assets, not some third-party institution. But that also means that you're responsible for the security. Now, you can, of course, open an account on an exchange and let them manage your funds. But the reality is that they are big, big targets for hackers and criminals, including state-sponsored criminals. And so there is a risk. So what I tell my friends and family is, okay, great, go trade on a reputable exchange like Gemini. But, you know, when you're storing your cryptocurrency, store it somewhere else where you control it and make sure it's backed up and you've put layers of protection in to make sure that everything is kept safe and protected.
Yeah. So maybe can you take us actually a little bit through, you know, the slight quick history tour evolution of security in the space. So, you know, we started with passwords and we were just chatting right before. There was an article a few days ago that the SolarWinds CEO was blaming the intern for the hack. And the hack was that the password was SolarWinds123. And you know, you keep on hearing this, don't have your password be password123 or company123. And people still do this, right? So there are passwords, there are hard passwords, there are password managers, two-factor authentication, there are hard keys that go into your USB drive. Can you take us through a little bit of kind of this history of security and how it's evolved? And then let's talk a little bit about the risks, right? So what are the different risks out there in the environment that people should think about?
Sure. So, security in general, as I was saying earlier, you know, we have that with the banking system and with all our online accounts. And so in the last 20 years or so, we've seen those systems kind of get more sophisticated. So, you know, 20 years ago, it was just a password. And then we started having rules about, you know, make sure there's a character and a symbol and some other things. So passwords became a little more complicated. In fact, they became, you know, people started instituting a character limit so that your password had to be more than 8 characters long. And so this led to people, you know, feeling like they're not going to remember the password. And so then we saw password managers come in where in many cases they will auto-generate a completely random password for you and store it for you. And so when you need the password for that account, it's able to kind of automatically paste that in and you log in. And then we saw Apple a few years ago, and I'm sure this happens on Android as well, provide sort of support for that in the operating system. So dealing with passwords, relatively straightforward day to day. But you definitely still don't want to have, you know, password 123 or anything basic like that. As we've seen more and more businesses move online, there's been more and more hacking attacks. And so having a hard-to-guess password is critical. Not using the same password on multiple accounts is also critical. A lot of hacking really has, you know, again, in the last sort of 20 years, has been about hacking into the databases that corporations have, stealing that information, and then, you know, forcing access to the account itself. And so if you have the same password in multiple accounts, if some corporation gets compromised with your details, it's quite possible that they'll be able to access other accounts that were not compromised, but they are compromised because you're using the same password. So moving on from just passwords, characters, long passwords, there was this notion of people should use two-factor authentication. So two-factor authentication is two different ways to get access to the account. So one could be your password. The other could be a code that is either sent to you on your phone or is generated from an app. Or, you know, I think like a decade ago, there were little devices, little RSA devices that banks would give their customers, which would generate the code automatically. Mm-hmm. And so you could use that to access your account. So definitely more secure. But as with anything, even as security technology innovation evolves, so do the hackers and the criminals going after those assets. And so what we've seen really with the surge of interest in cryptocurrency, this idea that the second factor on a two-factor authentication system might be that you're texted a code. And so what people have done is they have, this is called a SIM swap attack. And what happens is the hacker will take control of your phone. And there's various ways to do this. The simplest is literally to call up AT&T or Verizon or Sprint or whichever carrier and explain that you're in an emergency, your car broke down, you need to change phones. Could they, mm-hmm. could they reactivate this number on a different phone? And, you know, sometimes they fall for it. Not always, but definitely sometimes. And so the phone is ported to a different, the number is ported to a different phone. Then they do a password reset on your bank account, your cryptocurrency account, whatever it happens to be. Even I've had it done to me on my Facebook account. And then they send messages to people saying, hey, I really need, you know, can you send me a Bitcoin? I really need it. And people will fall for that. And so they're able to take control of your phone. It takes several days to get it back once you realize, and very, very problematic. And so that led to the idea that you shouldn't use your cell phone as the second factor in a two-factor authentication system. And so the recommended approach is actually to use an app. So there's several apps out there that you'll come across. There's Google Authenticator, Microsoft Authenticator, Authy, which is a great one. And these are apps that you configure on your phone, and they will generate the code to access your Instagram account or to access your Coinbase account. And so very relatively convenient. Obviously, there's a little bit of a learning curve there, but that makes that whole system much, much safer. So definitely a lot of evolution, you know, an idea. I kind of skipped over all of the biometric stuff that we're seeing, like Touch ID, Face ID, etc. But kind of skipping, so that was kind of very general, you know, high level security. But switching over to cryptocurrency specifically, so cryptocurrency is the native currency of the internet. You know, the basis is mathematics. Everything about it is digital, and so this poses some new sort of challenges in security. The biggest challenge is that with cryptocurrency, you have a public address that is the address that everyone uses to send you cryptocurrency. And you have a private key that maps to that address that you use to keep your assets secure in a wallet. And so if you lose that private key, you basically lose the assets. They're in your custody, you own them. But if you lose access to them, it's like you lost them physically, even though they're digital. So that private key becomes a proxy for the actual assets themselves. And so it becomes very, very important to protect that private key. So this private key is a long number that very, very few people can remember, although there are people out there that will memorize these things. And in the early days of cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, 11 years ago, people were super, super paranoid about this. Quite correctly, they were super paranoid about this. And they constructed very, very impressive schemes to make sure that sequence of digits was always kept secure, that it never went anywhere near the internet, that it never moved from one place to another, that it was restricted to one device or one system, and was just not exposed anywhere at all. So that really was kind of a lot to do with some of the limitations that existed 11 years ago in the landscape of security technologies. So let me give you an example. This is a pretty famous example. The Winklevosses, after they got their settlement from their lawsuit against Facebook, they started to invest that money in Bitcoin. And they quickly, as they were, at the time they were learning about Bitcoin and the blockchain and how everything worked, they were one of the largest investors at that time and continue to be. But they realized that they had to do something very sophisticated with the security. So they created they created the wallets that they were going to put their cryptocurrency in, their Bitcoin, and they generated the private key. They printed it out onto paper, and then they cut it up into pieces. And they took each piece, and they, between the two of them, they flew to to a bunch of regional airports, and then went to banks that were like 30 minutes from the airport, opened a safety deposit box, and put one of the pieces in each of these banks. And so they did that over like 48 hours. So the only way to kind of get access to that cryptocurrency is to figure out which banks are holding the safety deposit boxes, get access to the safety deposit boxes, and then get access to all the pieces, recombine them to get access to the accounts. So very, very complicated, no way to figure any of that information out. And then what they did with the computer that they used to generate the private key, they smashed it up with sledgehammers and buried it in the concrete of their new building that they housed their offices in. And then they did the same thing to the printer that printed the private key. So they were absolutely paranoid that no device, nothing that touched that string of digits was ever, accessible to anyone in any way. Other people have engraved this stuff on rings. Many people will tell you, if you're creating a new wallet, make sure there's no cameras around. We all have, people have home security cameras. You don't want to do it in the presence of a home security camera. You don't want anyone looking at this thing, because if someone wants to take those funds, all they need is the number. They don't need to steal it from you. They just need a copy of that number and or that private that private key, and they can take it. So back in 2009, 2010, 2011, there were very few ways to really sort of protect yourself and to securely store that number that was so critical. And so that resulted in products like hardware wallets. Hardware wallets are devices, small devices that encrypt your seed phrase or your private key, and they're not connected to the internet in any way. They're completely, what we call air gapped. So there's just no way that anyone can hack into it. And this became kind of the de facto way that people would, you know, people with large balances of Bitcoin would store their seed phrases and their private keys, etc. So super secure. The other thing that kind of goes hand in hand with hardware wallets is you do need to set it up, and so you would connect it to a computer to kind of configure it, but you don't want that computer connected to the internet. And so people talk about, well, I have an air gap computer where I create my key there, and then it's connected to the hardware device, the hardware wallet, and that will be completely safe because it's never been anywhere near the internet. It's never been near any malware, etc. So that's kind of been the de facto standard.
So
go ahead.
Can I jump in and just ask you a quick question? I'm writing down a couple of things. There's a lot of amazing themes here, which I want to touch upon. But really quickly, in the hardware wallet, like you said, you can create a private key on an air gap computer. You know, maybe two things. What do you need to actually do that? Because don't you need a piece of software to actually create the public and private key of your new wallet? That's maybe one. And two, for the hardware wallet, I mean, all of these come with, you know, software. Like I have a Trezor wallet, and it comes with, you know, we have a software upgrade. So it's going to reinstall a software to the wallet periodically. And it comes with a piece of software that helps visualize the wallet in an easier way when it plugs in. You know, how much does that decrease the efficacy of the wallet now that it's connected?
Well, I think that, you know, all of these vendors have created like the methodologies for how you use the wallet, how you apply an update, how you connect it with the computer, all of those kinds of things. And your responsibility is, well, make sure the computer that you're connecting to isn't online, right? So that no malware can come onto it. You should never buy these hardware wallets online from anyone other than the manufacturer of that wallet, because someone could have bought a bunch, you know, put malware on them, and then be reselling them on Amazon. So there's sort of responsibilities that the manufacturers have that mitigate a lot of the risks. And then there's responsibilities, you know, you don't want to be programming your ledger with a camera facing you that someone could hack into. So you have responsibilities, they have responsibilities, and that, you know, dramatically reduces the risk. But the point that I wanted to make, and it's kind of connected to what you asked, is when you look at the kind of like the next 500 million people that are going to come into crypto this year onwards, they don't, you know, they are not thinking about security. They're not thinking about, oh, I've got to make sure that there's no digital footprint. And like those concepts don't even enter into the conversation. You know, everyone's like, Bitcoin went up and Ethereum's going up and this is what's going on in DeFi. It's so exciting. People are not even at that level of, oh, but there's a danger here. And so, you know, everyone in the industry, the hardware wallet manufacturers, the software wallet manufacturers, everyone is thinking through, how do we make this easy? And there's some basic things that, you know, simply aren't that, you know, it's complicated. It's complicated to set up a hardware wallet. It's going to take a long time before we have some way of doing it that is so simple that everyone can do it without thinking. It's a complicated thing, and it needs to be done carefully. So this is a challenge. And the other challenge is what I was saying, that people aren't even thinking about security. And so I'm going to talk about it now, but one of the things that we did, obviously delivering a solution to help people protect their assets, was we built a website that explains why you should care about crypto security, what those things are, and how you do some of those things in a safe and secure way. There's many, many different ways to many, many different approaches and methodologies to follow. But we kind of give you an idea of, well, what's the risk if you do it this way? What's the risk if you do it that way? And there's many, many options available to people that they probably don't even know about. But it starts with understanding the risks. And we identified sort of five big categories of risks. So leaving your cryptocurrency on an exchange, storing your cryptocurrency locally on a computer or a USB drive, doing things that result in you being targeted by criminals. What I'm going to refer to as inheritance or loss of inheritance, because guess what? You did such a good job protecting your cryptocurrency that no one knows how to access it. And this has happened time and time again to people, even people that were very, very careful about protecting their assets. So if it's okay, I'd like to just kind of go into details on that. The other thing to say is...
Yeah, can I... Wait.
Go ahead.
Can I actually ask you a quick question before we go into it? I'm jotting a bunch of things down because, again, very, very fascinating. I do want you... Can you please explain at some point, right? So what the Winklevoss did is extremely secure, right? I mean, theoretically, you could recreate their steps, but it takes a massive amount of effort to go and do that, to find out the various cities and the banks and so on and so forth, right? But I think the trade-off there is accessibility. Now they have this Bitcoin. The whole point, right, of Bitcoin is that it's either wealth, right, you can use it for transactions. Regardless, it's this asset that you have, right? So you can kind of like gold. You can bury the gold and leave it on the ground, but then you can't really access it. At some point, you want to come access it, take it out, borrow against it, sell it, use it, convert it, right? It's all good to have money that you can't use, but then what's the point? So if they want to go back and access some of their old buried, so to speak, Bitcoin, right, that are buried in all these PO boxes or safety deposit boxes in the banks, even if they want to, let's say they have 1,000 in there, right, and they want to use one, and they've exhausted their stash, I don't know, of 10 that they have to decide to play with. They have to go back and, you know, go to each bank in order to get the private key, send one into, you know, some sort of soft wallet or connected wallet and put on an exchange or borrow against it or do something with it, right? So I guess there's a trade-off between extremely hard security, right, and usability. And will that ever be bridged?
Well, people have been trying to figure that out for decades, right? There is no security without usability. That's kind of like that's an axiomatic thing. And so, you know, I literally spent the last 3 months like documenting how wallets told you how to set up how to set up a wallet. And we looked at what do they tell you from a security perspective. And some of them ignore it and just get you through the process straight away and kind of don't even talk about why something is so, so important. And others go to extreme lengths in explaining it and popping up warnings and things like that. The whole thing is very, very, it's very, very complicated. And I don't think anyone has solved it. So the best we can do is make sure that people know what the risks are and kind of what they're
You went away from me for a second there.
Yeah,
there we go.
Yeah.
I think you came back.
Putting stuff in safety deposit boxes is probably a good thing, you know, certainly for physical goods. But safety deposit boxes are not insured. Mistakes happen. They get lost. You hear the horror stories. I think the New York Times published an expose on this last year. And then, you know, in the pandemic that we just had, you know, they weren't the most accessible mechanism, right?
Yeah.
You couldn't necessarily get access to them when you needed them. I mean, you couldn't necessarily get access to gold either, but, you know. So there are definitely pros and cons across the board. And I think, you know, many, many people choose to transact on exchanges, and that's kind of what you have to do. That's just part of buying cryptocurrency. That's how you do it. But you don't have to leave everything there. You can start to take steps to make it more secure by controlling the security. The other thing I wanted to say was, we're not stuck in 2010 or 11. Technology has moved forward. So even with devices like the iPhone, which, you know, maybe the 2009 version wasn't the most secure device ever made. But over the years, there's been dramatic changes to the security architecture of both iOS and Android devices. People refer to this as security enclave. And this is an architecture that ensures that people can't get access to whatever's stored inside that enclave. And so we hear about this all the time, right? The FBI or the police want access to someone's phone and Apple can't actually help them. And it becomes a very, very difficult process to kind of extract anything out of the phone. So in general, technologies and products have improved. You still got to figure out which ones are going to make sense for you so that it has the right amount of convenience, but you still have the protection and the backups and all of those kinds of things.
And can you touch upon really quickly? So, you know, one of the criticisms I've heard in the industry, especially for people that are very bullish on Bitcoin and Bitcoin only, so the Bitcoin maxis, is to say, you know, the wallet that you should choose is a Bitcoin only wallet, because if you choose a multi-currency wallet that has, you know, more software, more room for more holes essentially, or more room for entry, you know, so especially when you get into the Ethereum world where you have a bunch of ERC20 tokens, and maybe now in the Cardano world and Polkadot world where they have other kind of native tokens building on them. But the point is, you know, Bitcoin only versus multi-currency, is there a trade-off in kind of fault lines if the wallet is multi-currency?
I don't have a personal opinion on that, so I'm gonna pass on that. I think with choosing wallets, it really does boil down to it's a personal choice, and the choice depends on how easy is it to use and do the things that you need to do on it. And like I said, we documented like 10 of the top wallets and wrote down all the steps, and you can literally just scroll through that and see, oh, well, this one has a lot of pages, so this is a little more complicated. So there's the ease of use aspect. There's what types of coins are you going to store on there? So that's kind of the multi-currency, single currency issue. But there's some other things like, privacy. Are any of these wallets exposing your personal details to anyone else? When you set up an account, are you putting in a bunch of extraneous information? How anonymous can you be? So it's a combination of all of those things. Some of the best wallets out there, some of the most popular wallets out there, like Binance's wallet, Trust Wallet, you know, have a lot of options, and people will use that. There's other people who will not touch a software wallet with a barge pole. They will, you know, only use hardware wallets that have been configured with air-gapped computers, and that's what they do. It's a very personal thing. I don't think anyone is the expert on saying this wallet is great and this wallet is not so great. We stayed away from that. We simply documented the steps and pointed out the security implications along the way, because vendors don't necessarily do that. They want you to get your wallet set up and configured and then start trading cryptocurrency, because that's how that is the purpose of the wallet.
Sure. And then so a couple more points. So going to the, you know, ultra kind of ultra protection, you know, there's this the kind of, I think it's called the dead man switch. Basically, it says that, hey, if I don't do X, you know, once per week, then, you know, erase all the data or move the funds from one account to another. I guess it's the ultimate crypto anarchist. If they get caught by the government and the government saying, give me your keys, give me your private keys, or we know that you have a wallet, and then you're like, well, I didn't do X action over the last week or the last month, so it shipped somewhere. Are there tools to actually set that up? I mean, if someone wants to get all super, super hunkered down in security.
Well, if I told you, I'd have to kill you. So I'm not going to get into that. I've not personally come across that. but it sounds great for a Hollywood movie. I'm sure this technology or these approaches exist, but they're not things that regular folks implement. We'll see. One of my favorite authors, Ben Masaryk, he's written a lot of great books, but he wrote the book that was turned into the movie The Social Network, which was about Facebook. And then when he heard that the Winklevosses had become billionaires, he went back and revisited his notes and said, well, this is kind of incredible. This is amazing that two people who were involved, you know, at this genesis moment of social media, you know, come back a few years later and are at the genesis moment of Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. And so he wrote another book called Bitcoin Billionaires. And so he actually talks a lot about, he has a whole chapter on security, and he actually puts in a lot of the detail that I described earlier about the safety deposit boxes. But he's now the writer on Billions. So I'm sure that we, you know, when the second half of the last season comes on shortly, we will see some more sophisticated cryptocurrency maneuvering by the characters on Billions. Maybe this will be part of it.
It's an incredible show. And actually, it's funny, we talk a lot about The Social Network. So a good friend of mine and Shimon's, Divya and Narendra, it was four. Mark, right, the Winklevoss twins, and Divya. Divya was part of that whole gang in the beginning. And he went to business school with us. And so there were many conversations about that stage of kind of the world and life when all of this has taken place. But just moving away from security for a second and going into, you want to call it irony of life or investments or in general, the ironic part here, right, is that Mark Zuckerberg took Facebook away from them. It doesn't matter how or whether he was wrong or not, but he ended up with Facebook, right, and started running Facebook and was focused 100% on growing Facebook. Now Facebook is getting a lot of heat from, you know, the fact that they're trying to, you know, spy on you in terms of ads and so on. And he's been so heads down on this innovator's dilemma, right, of perfecting this product that he's made, that had he literally at that point in time taken all of his wealth and did what the Winklevoss twins have done, given Bitcoin's price and given where we believe it's going to go, he would have been orders of magnitude better off than focusing and working on the company. And it's just, to me, it's this weird, interesting irony of life and an incredible example of an innovator's dilemma and the most high-tech, innovative company you can argue over the last, you know, 15 years or so. And even still, so they were looking at cryptocurrencies, and Facebook came up with Libra, which is a Facebook, you know, bespoke kind of, you know, cryptocurrency, which kind of went nowhere. Had they just said, hey, we're going to take your identity and that's going to become your identity wallet and you can send across Bitcoin and shop with Bitcoin through Facebook and Facebook Marketplace, they would have been, again, orders of magnitude ahead of where they are now just by focusing on the technology that existed. So it's, I know it's an aside to our whole conversation about security, but it's just an interesting kind of rule, if you will, or just happening of innovation, where you always get into this innovator's dilemma. Once you're in so deep, it's hard to unsee the world from the perspective that you're in.
I love that when Facebook announced, when they announced their cryptocurrency play, the Winklevoss tweeted, "Welcome to the party. What took you so long?"
Yes. Yes, exactly. And it's amazing. One, I know I cut you off on you. There was a couple more risks and you wanted to go with them, but I wanted to bring up to our audience something that you talked about and it was very implicit, but I want to bring it up top. So right in the beginning, you talked about how, hey, you know, people have two-factor authentication on the phone and you can have a SMS message coming to your SIM card, but that can also be hacked. I think what's implicit behind there is how you talked about getting hacked. And so essentially social engineering, right? So you call AT&T and you say, move the phone number over. And then you said, you have a brilliant example. You find someone's, let's say, Facebook account, and then you log in as them and message your friends and say, hey, I'm in trouble, send me a Bitcoin or send something over to this address. And the address is, you know, someone else's and it's gone. And this started with the internet, right? When you had these Nigerian princes emailing into, especially a lot of the, unfortunately, I think older folks who are unsophisticated with the internet, who got taken by, you know, send me the money and I'll send X back. But there's this whole element of outside of that high tech security, this whole element of social engineering, which bypasses a lot of these technological solutions. Because it's just an element that I think is growing. And in the world of cryptocurrencies, we're going to have to be hyper aware of, you know, we have deep fakes now, and that's on the tech side, but all these social engineering schemes that are going to come up more and more and more of someone logging in as you on Facebook and saying, send me something because I'm in trouble. Please, I just send me a quick Bitcoin. I'm in, I don't know, Albania, right? It takes an hour to send the Bitcoin over and then you have it and it's not that person. So are you guys thinking about that, you know, at all? And I know you guys use the concept of guardians, right? So you send it to five or six friends, especially with Vault 12, and they each one has a piece of the puzzle. What if those friends get hacked? You know, how do you guys think about social engineering and solving for that?
So we thought about that a great deal. And so we came up with a couple of there's a couple of things built into the core design of what we do that reduces a lot of the risks. So the first thing is, instead of saying, you know, online, pick five people, you know, pick five of your favorite Facebook friends, and then everything's done online. We ask you to pick people that you know. And so if you know them, then their names are in your contact, you know, your contact list, on your phone. The invitation is obviously electronic because we want them to get a link, but you can send that link directly to them, through text, through email, etc. So we give you a few different ways outside the app itself to kind of contact them. Then the core system is such that, let's say you have 10 guardians. The system requires you to say, what's the minimum number of those guardians that's needed to okay getting access to an asset? So you would typically say, I've got 10 guardians, but five of them have to send me the okay when I need to get access or I need to recover the vault because I lost my phone. And so there's this redundancy built in. So, you know, if someone loses their phone is stolen, they changed phones, or indeed their phone got hacked and they had to kind of wipe it or something like that, you still have the ability to recover and access your funds, regardless, of one person being down. Hacking into any one of those guardians is not going to give anyone any useful information. You actually need, you know, five of the pieces, or, you know, three of the pieces, depending on how you set it up. And so for our more high net worth use cases, those guardians might be in different countries. One of the risks that I didn't talk about was natural disasters. You have to leave the home because your home's on fire, and you don't take the piece of paper that you wrote your seed phrase on, and you don't take the USB device. You also, in this scenario, want to make sure that you're not, you know, all your guardians aren't in an area where there could be an earthquake or a fire or a mudslide. You spread them out, and so having that distribution also helps with reducing your exposure. So we did a lot of things like that. The confirmation process is also, it's not done by pressing a button or sending a digital signal. We do it where you have to call them up and then they do something. So when you're actually speaking to them live on the phone or through, you know, through a messaging app or a voice app, then things can progress. And so we made it a little more, you actually have to kind of do something more extraordinary than normal to accomplish certain things. And that's what gets in the way. That's what kind of reduces the risks associated with identity and social engineering and some of those kinds of things.
It's probably a nice balance of friction that you've created, because it is added friction versus, you know, this extra added protection against social engineering. And I, this is why I was really taken to your solution when I first saw it, is because it's not just, like you said, an electronic signal where, you know, somebody, it typically, you know, if you have 10 people and you have to have 6 or 7 OKs out of 10, it's going to be very hard for somebody to hack all 7, right, or all 10. But it does add a layer against social engineering, where it's not just an electronic signal that can potentially be intercepted, you know, each way. There's some sort of component to, you know, calling that person. So I really appreciated that, because I think it's an understated aspect of security that very few people talk about. And there, you know, if you watch, and you've lived this, right? But if for our audience, if you watch any security, like a 60 Minutes in Security, any shows, you'll see how actually incredibly fairly easy it is to get to pass security in a secure building if you just social engineer a story to get through and talk your way into places. And people are people, you know, they make human errors and human mistakes, and there's emotion and empathy and so on. So social engineering actually works, you know, maybe quite well. I don't know, to our detriment about people, you know, getting through protection layers.
It can often undo the most, you know, the most thought through, you know, approaches that people put in. I think the other end of the spectrum is that you came up with a scheme where everything is super protected and you have everything locked away, engraved on a cylinder in a safe, but no one knows the combination to the safe. And so if you were to become incapacitated, you passed away, no one can actually get access. And so this happens. It happened earlier this year, and it was publicized, and a lot of people were mailing the story around, where someone has their Bitcoin on a hard drive, and they protected the hard drive with encryption. And then there's a PIN number for accessing the disk, so you can actually take data off the disk and see what the private key is. And he's forgotten the PIN. Or he's forgotten the PIN and he has, you know, 3 more tries before the disk becomes irrecoverable. So there's a lot of things here that can prevent access to your funds.
Yeah, there was 200 million on it. I know we're coming up with time. I want to ask you how people can get in touch, but there's one aspect we didn't touch upon, which I think is super critical. So if you may, inheritance, right? So this is maybe a good segue to that, passing on your wealth to your children, because this is a generational shift in wealth, especially in cryptocurrencies. And so it's very prudent for our audience to start thinking about, you know, what are you going to do with this nest egg? How can you pass it on in a safe way?
Yeah, so the traditional way to do this is that you obviously you still need to talk to a lawyer. You still need a trust and estates attorney to kind of help you through this process. With traditional bank accounts, there's many ways to pass that information on, but with cryptocurrency, it all revolves around passing on the credentials to your wallets. So you have to make a list of all of your wallets, and you have to make a list of all of the private keys or seed phrases for those wallets. And every time you add an asset to your collection, and maybe your approach is you create a new wallet for that asset, you have to make sure it's all written down, or you know, it's all available in one place. So the inventory of your crypto assets is really, really important. And so once you have that, then you can, you know, put that in a safety deposit box or whatever. And then your lawyers can make sure that, you know, or the executor of the will can make sure that that information is passed on. Well, that whole approach is very messy, because people don't always create the inventory. It's very difficult to recreate an inventory after the fact. If you're writing it down, now you're subject to all the kind of things that paper is subject to, like fire, or getting wet, or not being able to read it. And if you're passing it on to your lawyers, you know, suddenly you've taken something that's very, very critical and you've exposed it to other people. And so there's a lot of risks all the way through. And so what we did was we said, well, you know, with a vault, with a digital vault, you're already putting stuff in the vault. So everything is there already. You know, all of your wallets are the credentials for those are in the vault anyway. What if we made one of the guardians your beneficiary? And so you could just set up an agreement automatically between you as the owner of the assets and one of your beneficiaries. And then when the time comes, the beneficiary is able to recreate the vault. So typically with Vault 12, only the owner can recreate the vault. He needs access. He needs the okay from his guardians or her guardians. But in this scheme, the beneficiary is able to recreate the vault. Now, if they try to do that when you're still around and it's kind of unauthorized or unorthodox, you can veto it. And there's some time limits built in. But it was a very nice way to kind of to wrap that around the security that we're already providing, because all of the assets were, you know, the directions to those assets were all stored in one place and didn't need to be disclosed to lawyers or, you know, intermediaries or third parties, etc.
Yeah, I was going to say, I love that. I love the that solution. And we're coming up on time, so I want to thank you. But I, for first, you know, for our listeners, vault12.com. And let's see, maybe tell us a little bit about where people can find you. And especially, I know there's a website, I think it's vault12.com/learn, where they can go and learn about the hardware and the software wallets. But I remember you guys did a better, there was a different URL, which is great. It was like cryptowallet.org or something along those lines, or crypto safety. What was that URL?
Sure. So all the stuff about the product is on vault12.com. But the information about security and how to secure your cryptocurrency is on a site called securemycrypto.org, securemycrypto.org. And over time, we're actually going to have contributors adding additional articles. We're busy documenting the next 10 software wallets and hardware wallets. And so there'll be more articles coming along. So I really recommend that people have a browse through. And as you know, as they're going through setting up their environments, and if you have friends who are you know coming into crypto, new to crypto, this is a good site to read before they you know go deeply into it, so they understand what risks are out there and what choices they can make.
Yeah, and I would say I've been in the crypto space since 2016, so I guess I'm not an OG, but I'm a you know kind of an OG in the space, and I spent hours into the night reading all about the different wallets and security features. One, because I love it, but two, because it's so informational. There's just so much, and I love the way you guys lay it out wallet by wallet. And if you have, you know, MetaMask, here's what you do, you know, and if you have Coinbase wallet or exchange wallet, here's what you do. Here's the pros and cons. It's a very neutral, fact-based discussion. And, you know, this space is going to become bigger and bigger. And for our listeners, it's very, very imprudent for you to go check it out. Just brush up on this, invest the hour or two that's needed to read up on this, because it's literally going to cost, you know, the flip side is costing you thousands of dollars. And that's not something that anyone wants to lose. And so, again, thank you so much for coming on. Wasim, it was an incredible conversation. I hope we can have you back on again, because I have tons of questions that I can still want to ask you and go deeper on. But thank you again. And for our listeners, hardcorefinance.com, please subscribe. Feedback. We always love feedback. Leave us comments, notes. Let us know what other topics you would like to hear about. And we'll keep on bringing kind of the latest and greatest in the industry. So Wasim, thank you again. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.